session. That's, of course, the first announcement. It was mentioned in the earlier session. We are compressing the afternoon session into a final talk in this session that will be given by Colin Lonsdale and will be an overview of, some of you may have noticed that some of us have taken a couple of minutes here and there during the meeting to discuss the organization of the EHT as a collaborative consortium, and Colin will talk about this at the end. We have one more change in the program, which is a swap of the Jonathan Weintraub's talk and Shep Dolman's talk, so Shep will now bat cleanup in this session, and then we'll hear from Colin at the end. Before we start, since this is the last session, I do want to suggest that we all recognize this has been an extraordinary conference venue, and not just the organization that was done by Avery and his team, but everything from the audiovisual to the wonderful food to the fact that the door is always open to us pretty much around the clock. This has been just extraordinary. So please, a round of applause for the Perimeter Institute and the organizers of the meeting. And we'll begin the session with Michael Johnson of the Center for Astrophysics at Harvard, who will continue in the theme of telling us about what to do with sparse images.
Okay, so can everyone hear me okay? Good, excellent. Okay, so I want to talk a little about deblurring Sag A-star images, and that is to say to remove the final effects of scattering. We worked very hard to get down to wavelengths that are short enough that scattering is subdominant, but as a few people have already noted, it's still an important effect, and the question is, what can we do about it? I'm really representing Vincent Fish, who wrote this recent paper outlining many of the ideas that I'll talk about, and it was really a fun collaboration. I think it involved observers, scattering theorists, computer scientists, and also people from the computer vision community. So we're drawing on a lot of different expertise, and I think that's important as we continue to move forward here. So this plot, I think, kind of tells the story, and Shep showed how this is kind of a march towards shorter wavelengths that many, many different people have participated in and represents, you know, huge efforts in VLBI to get down to the 1.3 millimeter that we are now. Just so that we're all clear, the red points here show the measured size of Sag A star at a particular wavelength. And what you see is that this is falling steeply when you go to shorter wavelengths. And the reason for this is that at longer wavelengths, it's being scattered in the interstellar medium, and so you see this large Gaussian scattering disk. As you go to the shorter wavelengths, you begin to see a departure from the smooth power law, and that's where we think that the source structure is beginning to poke out. So the measured size is a combination of the intrinsic source size and the scattering, and you can deconvolve the effects of scattering to get an inferred intrinsic size even when you're scattering dominated. And that suggests that the inferred size is also a steep function of wavelength. So what's going on? Scattering arises from turbulence in the interstellar medium. Okay, so whereas things like dispersion and rotation measure would occur in a smooth, dilute plasma as long as it's magnetized, for scattering, it's all because of the irregularities, and because of that, it's stochastic by its very nature. Okay, so scattering really leads to three effects: angular broadening, which we observe, and this is important for us. Also, temporal broadening, which we can now study with the magnetar, and this is studied with many different pulsars. And also scintillation, so twinkling, variations across a frequency band, or in time, or in changing the positioning in the observing plane. So what happens is that the scattering causes many different random phase additions to an incoming signal, so it sort of crinkles a nice smooth wave front. And what we see then is the result of this crinkling far away. And there's a nice analogy here, and that's that stars twinkle. Stars twinkle for the same reason, and it was actually Newton who first correctly identified this as being caused by atmospheric scattering. Now, the other half of the story is that planets don't twinkle. Now, of course, planets also scatter through the atmosphere, but they have a much larger angular size. So radiation from different points on a planet will superimpose slightly offset copies of the same diffraction pattern at your eye, and that tends to smear it out. And the punchline here is just that a large source can quench the scintillation. It can suppress the effects of scattering in some way. So there are really three regimes of the scattering, and these were identified by Narayan and Goodman in 1989. The first is called the snapshot image. And this would correspond if you just have a point source and strong scattering. There's a lot of structure and twinkling and frequency and time and space. And we see this for pulsars at radio wavelengths regularly. Now the next regime is called the average image. There are a couple of ways to get here. For pulsars, you could just average in time or average across a bandwidth. That would put you in this regime. For Sagittarius star, the extent of the source actually quenches that scintillation in the snapshot regime, so we get here for free. The last regime is called the ensemble average image. Okay, this you would get to by even longer averaging in time. Okay, and the beautiful thing about the ensemble average scattering is that it's deterministic. Now, scattering is most easily described in terms of a thin screen that imparts just a random phase to your incoming wavefront that depends on the location of the screen. Okay, and the most convenient mathematical way to describe this is through the phase structure function. So this tells you just what the mean squared difference is of neighboring phases based on how apart they are. So it's telling you about the correlation structure of the scattering screen. Now, the form of this is very simple, and I just want to point out right now that by its very form, it's real, it's positive, and it's symmetric. Okay, and we'll come back to that in a moment. And to describe it, you actually only need a couple pieces of information. You need to know where the turbulence is injected, what it looks like when it's active in the inertial range, so it'll be scale-free, and so you just need a power law index there. And then at some point, it's going to become, it'll be dissipated, and the scattering will be smooth. So we just need these few pieces of information to completely describe the scattering, and this perhaps you can think of it as a toy model. Now, the reason we like this is because the phase structure function is very simply related to what we see in the ensemble averaged image. Okay, so in interferometry, what you'll see is that a visibility on a particular baseline is just given by the exponential of minus a half times the phase structure function on that baseline divided by a magnification factor. And that's just related to where the scattering occurs along the line of sight. Now, the other part of this that's so beautiful is that for an extended source, the scattering is just a convolution. And that's very powerful. It tells us that the image is just uniformly blurred by scattering. And in a sort of miracle, and one of the only advantages to observing in the visibility domain, the scattering in the visibility domain is then just multiplication. So it just multiplies all the visibilities you measure by a kernel that's given above, and that just depends on baseline. So it's very simple to describe the effects of scattering on our measurements. Now, because of those properties I mentioned earlier, some VLBI quantities are unaffected by the scattering. So because this point source kernel is point symmetric, it has no associated closure phase. And what that means is that in your measurements, closure phase will be unaffected by ensemble average scattering. Also, because it's a multiplication in the visibility domain, anytime you take a quotient of visibilities, that will also be independent of the scattering. So things like fractional polarization are independent as well. So revisiting this plot from before, you know, there's this lambda squared scaling, and this came up the other day. And this is actually quite special, and the reason is that 2 is exactly twice 1. And what's happening here is that if you're in a regime where the phase fluctuations are smooth, then the phase structure function has to be quadratic, and there are two consequences. One is that the scattering kernel will be Gaussian. And as Jeff mentioned the other day, this is seen at long wavelengths and short wavelengths, and scattering is always Gaussian as far as we can tell. And the second is that the scaling of the scattering with frequency will exactly follow this lambda squared behavior. So there's nothing magical about this. It's just telling us that the scattering is occurring in a regime where the fluctuations that are leading to the angular broadening are in a phase range where the phases are smooth. And this is actually consistent with kind of our physical expectations for the scattering material. Okay, so in terms of observations, all we have to do is we have to take our measurements and we have to multiply them by some factor. And this is easy to estimate what the factor is by just using the longer wavelength calculations. On our short baselines here, they pick up about 1.5% of additional flux. But on long baselines, they actually pick up about 50% more flux. And the thing is, the scattering kernels, you know, it's changing rapidly as a function of baseline, and it also depends on your orientation in the visibility plane. So we've seen these wonderful results from APEX, and I would encourage us to begin plotting quantities where we've removed the effects of scattering. Otherwise, we'll always be looking at an east-west elongated source, and that's just from the scattering, which is, you know, sadly not terribly interesting. So when showing these new results, and as we begin to accumulate more and more data, I think it's going to be important that we start representing it in terms of what we would see if the source was not scattered at all. Now, here's an example of what the full scattering kernel looks like at 230 gigahertz. And Dan Maroney showed this plot. It's very special. Our long north-south baselines and our longest east-west baselines all lie within regions where there's quite a bit of power in the scattering kernel. It never falls too much, which means its inversion is never going to be amplifying the noise by a huge factor. It's never more than a factor of 5. So then the question is, how well can we do in terms of applying this to actually imaging Sagittarius? So on the top, we have just an original simulation image from Avery Broderick. And then to the right of that, we see what it looks like after adding the blurring effects of scattering. And you can see that especially that photon ring is really hard to recover. Now, immediately below, we see what we would get if we tried to reconstruct the scattered visibilities. And of course, that does a very nice job of reconstructing the scattered image. However, if we first multiply our visibilities by the inverse of that kernel, and then we reconstruct the image, you can see that it does a much better job of reproducing that unscattered original image. And we can see features like the photon ring again. Now, you might wonder, you know, is this applicable at longer wavelengths? And the answer is absolutely. However, at longer wavelengths, the scattering kernel falls off much, much more steeply. And so here are a bunch of baselines, you know, from the VLBA and when you add the LMT and ALMA and so forth. And you can see that many of your baselines will probably have no flux at all after the scattering. So what scattering is really trying to do is it's trying to hide any information on scales that are smaller than that the scale of that scattering kernel. Okay, it's very hard to recover that information. But if we're in a regime where you're dominated by the size of the source, and the scattering is kind of an afterthought, it's subdominant, then we can do a lot to invert its remaining effects. So just to summarize this, the blurring from scattering is deterministic, and it's invertible. The scattering is effectively just amplifying our thermal noise on the long baselines. It's a signal-to-noise game, and it's something that we can understand quite well. The mitigation strategy is also quite simple. You just divide visibilities by the known kernel, and then you image using the rescaled visibilities. That image is going to be sensitive to the unscattered image of the source. And you can do the same thing for all of these model testing ideas as well. Now, there are two limitations to this approach. The first is, do we actually know the scattering kernel at 1.3 millimeters? And as Dimitrios mentioned, you know, this is a major concern that perhaps we don't. And it's something that we can learn more about with additional observations. The second is the ensemble average regime really a good approximation for our observations? And this is something that I'd like to devote the second half of the talk to. So recently, observations at 1.3 centimeters were able to resolve the Gaussian scattering disk of Sagittarius, but then on the longer baselines, they found that there was this persistent signal. Okay, so it turns out that this signal is stochastic, and it's purely from the scattering, and it's not unexpected. This was predicted in those papers by Narayan and Goodman. Now, the thing about this signal is that it has a correlation length that's about the size of the scale in which the visibility falls. So even though it looks like there are a lot of points there, they're actually all tightly correlated. They're all stochastic realizations, but we only have about 2 samples. So we can't learn too much, but we can begin to piece together a story for it. The other thing to keep in mind is that this noise falls very slowly with baseline. It will always win on long baselines. Okay, so this is discouraging. It means that once you've resolved the scattering disk, you're gonna rapidly hit a regime where you're dominated by this new type of noise. And there's no way to beat it down other than long averaging in time. And I would say that this is a somewhat bleak outlook for things like space VLBI of Sagittarius at 1.3 millimeters. You really have to start thinking about what it is that you're studying on long baselines. It's a great place to study the scattering. It's not a great place to study very fine-scale source structure. Now, the level of that scattering was something of that noise was about 10 millijanskis. But again, we only have 2 realizations and stochastic. So, you know, it's somewhere between, say, 5 and 20. And it turns out that this level of noise is most sensitive to the intrinsic source size, which is quenching it as you increase the source, and also the power loss scattering index. Now remember, we only see this lambda squared scaling. We never get a preview of what it looks like when the material's turbulent. So this is a nice way of actually getting into that regime, and this is giving us information about what it might look like for EHT observations where we don't see that pure scaling of the power law. Okay? And I think the beautiful thing here is that if you just draw a line for the intrinsic source structure inferred from deconvolution, and you draw a line for the power law index expected for a Kolmogorov spectrum, it intersects almost perfectly with just our sort of best guess of what these observations are telling us. So the key that I want to emphasize here is that this is not unexpected. This is not mysterious or complicated. This is all consistent with what we think we know. But the takeaway here is that in the regime where it's turbulent, the spectrum is going to be shallow. And so at some point on this plot, it's going to stop looking like lambda squared, and it's going to transition to something perhaps Kolmogorov. So understanding this is certainly important for us in terms of precision deconvolution approaches. And it's something that I really encourage additional observations at the longer wavelengths for us to understand this more precisely and predict what we'll see at the EHT observations. I think this also addresses Dimitrios's concerns because it's saying that these longer wavelengths observations do allow us to probe detailed properties of the scattering at a millimeter. You know, it's not all hidden behind this scattering screen. So, how would this look at 1.3 millimeters? And as Jeff mentioned, it turns out that this refractive noise is more important at higher frequencies. So it turns out if you were to take the refractive noise and plot it for a point source, it intersects almost exactly with the level of signal that we see on our long baselines. Okay, that's a little sobering, but of course, if Sagittarius were actually a point source, there would be some huge contribution, you know, a few Janskis on those long baselines, so we know it has to be extended. So if you put in the actual size of the source that we think is there, you know, say 40 microarc seconds, that'll kick your refractive noise down by quite a lot. And so this is a case where we actually would like the source to be large, because that's going to quench this scattering noise for us. The key, though, is that the effect is not a convolution, and this is just like we saw before. It's not going to decrease. It's not some fraction of the source flux on that baseline. It's some fraction of the zero baseline flux. Okay? And so this is why it always wins on long baselines, because your source flux is going to fall off, but the scattering substructure is going to remain. So here is what I would say is kind of the current best guess of what we have to work with in terms of EHT observations. If it were a point source, we'd be looking at 300 to 400 millijanskis. However, for an extended source of a kind of expected dimensions, it's going to be more like 100 millijanskis. And it's going to fall with baseline, but not terribly quickly. I think this is encouraging, but the situation's even better. The reason is that the refractive noise is going to be correlated on all EHT baselines because we're all within that scattering disk. We don't have any extremely long baselines. So the leading effect is just scaling your overall flux up and down by just a little bit. But once you normalize that out, you're already going to eliminate refractive noise on the zero baseline, as well as many of the short baselines, because they're all going to be tightly correlated. The next effect is going to be an overall image wander. OK, but none of our observables are sensitive to image wander. So actually, the two leading effects are things that are easy for us to remove. So I think that the residual effects that we have to worry about here are less than 100 millijanskis. So certainly important, but not game changers. I want to emphasize that simulations play an important role here. So the idea goes back to Ryan and Goodman. They did these simulations, and they did them for one dimension. It turns out that it works very well there. So what's shown here is just the average visibility, or that should really be the ensemble average visibility, and the refractive noise RMS on long baselines, iterating over many different simulations. And so the simulations in theory agree quite well. What we'd like to do is do a two-dimensional simulation, but these are very difficult. The reason is, say you want to do this at 1.3 centimeters. It turns out you need to simulate about 10 to the 15 correlated screen phases. Then for each point in the visibility domain you want to sample, you need a four-dimensional integral. Okay, two for the source, two for the scattering disk. This is just not computationally feasible. Even at 1.3 millimeters, you still need about a billion screen phases. So you're storing many gigabytes of memory just to lock in this screen, and you have to do a four-dimensional integral for every measurement, to determine every measurement over the whole screen. So it's still not possible However, in some cases, we can do analytical results, and we can make this tractable. So it turns out that if we look at some simple structures, we can eliminate all the integrals and get a preview of what this might look like. So the image all the way on the left is the unscattered source here. It's just a symmetric ring, no structure at all, and no fine scale structure and no time variability. Next figure is the ensemble average. Here it's just been blurred out a little bit, just like what we've seen already. Now the third and fourth panels show what you would actually see, you know, if you were staring at this and had perfect resolution. There's all of this patchy substructure, and if you could see perfectly, you would see that it's fractal. In the rightmost image, I've just blurred it out a little bit so you can get a better sense of how it might affect sort of EHT observations. It's neat, you can even make a movie of this. Okay, so here, what we have is we have that same ring, and there's a scattering screen in front of it. All of the structure you're seeing is from the scattering screen. And the reason it's varying in time is because that scattering screen is moving across your line of sight. Okay, this is called a frozen screen approximation, and it's very common. It's been demonstrated to be effective for pulsars and many other sources. For us, the refractive time scale, or the time it takes the screen to kind of move across the source, is about a day. So for us, one day is about 1 second in the simulation. But I think that this is an important consideration for precision tests of GR, looking at the shape of the shadow, for instance, or if you want to extract the spin of the black hole from the shadow. You can see that the shadow is hopping around, it's getting distorted by this effect. And so we either need to learn how to mitigate it more effectively, or we need to begin to understand, you know, ways of assembling multiple epochs of observation. If you were to take the average over all the frames in that movie, you would see this. Okay, so this looks quite similar to that ensemble average image that we talked about before, and it's perfect for deblurring. So clearly we need to understand ways in which we can use multiple epochs of observation to approximate the ensemble average and then applying this deblurring technique. Just to summarize, scattering is certainly important and it's still providing surprises. Our view of the scattering of Sagittarius star is completely different than it was 3 or 5 years ago. The dominant effect of scattering is blurring, okay? But this is perfectly invertible, and if we know the kernel, it's just like adding noise. So clearly we need more observations at longer baselines to determine the kernel, but as we continue to do this, it's just going to approach a regime where it's a signal-to-noise game. The subdominant effect is substructure. Averaging this will still give the ensemble average, so techniques like what Andrew mentioned that Frake has developed can still allow us to use this deblurring technique, even if the substructure is quite strong. Now, variations do distort single epoch images, and it seems that this 100 millijanzi noise is kind of a fundamental limit. That sounds scary, but it's not. Every observation has a fundamental limit. Pulsars, for instance, are limited by the noise of the source. So what I mean by this is just some limit that you can only circumvent by time averaging. Okay, but clearly we need to know exactly what this number is, and we have to understand all of these effects better and understand what additional mitigation techniques we can apply. So just a parting thought, you know, I would say the situation for precise tests of GR on Sagittarius star is unclear, but I'm very curious. I've never seen, or at least not here, I didn't see applications to M87, for instance, where the scattering is not as big of a problem, perhaps not a problem at all. So I'm curious about the power of tests of GR and shadow imaging on M87. I would love it if Tim or Demetrios could comment on that. So thank you.
Minutes for questions.
So that movie was really striking. One thing that jumped out is, of course, the correlation in time, which just do the frozen screen. Can you not use that to do something kind of like adaptive optics to de-scatter the image? So you have a long time sequence of these, you see these correlated features moving, you could model that realization of the screen and then take it out. Is that not possible?
I would say we are only beginning to understand what's possible. If you had asked me 2 weeks ago, I would have said it is absolutely impossible to simulate a scattering screen. And then it turns out there are simplifications. So Katie tells me, Katie Bauman from MIT, tells me that this type of scattering effect is actually quite amenable to non-blind deconvolution techniques. Actually, all of this information of scattering makes it easier to invert, and I think that your your observation that, you know, time variability has distinctive signatures is going to be an important part of that story. So I absolutely agree. I just think, you know, we have to put some work and some thought into it.
Yes. Go ahead, Jeff.
So, Michael, this is really terrific. How do your predictions change, at least qualitatively, in the case of a thick scattering screen or the Korda's model of the source embedded in a scattering screen?
So, I don't know, but I suspect that the original Narayan and Goodman papers took quite a bit of time to write and took, you know, us decades to understand. And, you know, we are barely beginning to understand this thin screen. So it's absolutely an important consideration of how does a uniform medium change things? How does it change the noise level, time scales, all of these questions? I don't know the answer. I don't have any intuition. And I think it's really going to take some effort to figure these questions out. But they're critical.
Yeah, this was great, Michael. What is the takeaway of this for hour-long flares or 10-minute flares?
That's an interesting point. I don't know the answer exactly. The story has always been that you don't see much refractive variation on short time scales. So you wouldn't really see much until you went to multiple days, you know, where the screen has really moved a lot. However, when you pair it with much finer spatial resolution, you know, these techniques that Andrew's talking about where you have closure phases and things like that, then maybe, you know, maybe effects on fractions of the refractive scale are more important. So I would say variations on hour timescales, I can imagine being an issue. Variations on minute timescales, it's really hard to see how scattering would do that. But yeah, great question.
I guess we have time for one more as Vincent sets up.
I can give you a very quick answer for your last question there. Everything scales linearly with the angular scale. So if the shadow has half the size, then all the effects will also have half the size. It's a little bit more complicated because you have the jet, but as a rule of thumb, that's how it goes.
So in your papers and talks, though, I maybe I've just missed it, but I don't typically see M87 mentioned. Is there any reason for that, or is it just that Sag A-star is a bit better, so that's the focus?
I think the framework works for both. Well, it works for any black hole. The simulations that I showed and the results, that was specific for Sag A-star.
Okay. Thank you.